This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
You're listening to Between the Covers. I'm Ren Green, and I'm here with actress and author Julia Sweeney to talk about her new book, If It's Not One Thing, It's Your Mother. Welcome, Julia.
Thanks for having me.
Tell us about your book.
Well, I wrote a book. It's sort of a memoir. It's sort of a collection of essays, and it's all about how I assembled my family. And I had an unexpected month free from my husband and daughter, pretty much free. And I just thought it was funny that I spent so much time trying to assemble my family. I adopted my daughter when she was, 17 months old from China, and I married my husband when she was 6 years old, and we all moved to the Midwest, Mulan and I did, to live with him. And I had gone through a lot of effort to make a family, and then once I had them, all I wanted to do was get away from them. They drove me crazy. And so I got this month away from them. And so during that time, I didn't write the whole book, of course, in 1 month, but I assembled all the essays and I write about what it's like to be alone and I reflect on how this all happened.
So you've had a really long and varied and interesting career. You've done TED Talks and you've worked with Jill Sobule and
Yes. You've
written and you've been in movies and you've done comedy. Which of these things have you enjoyed doing the most? Have gotten the most out of?
Oh, wow. That's really hard to say. Being on Saturday Night Live was really a highlight. That was really exciting. And there were moments on Saturday Night Live that are the highlights of my life. I mean, that felt like the most exciting thing to be doing. And it felt like it was the center of the universe at the time. And it was a very heady, exciting time. But satisfactorily, I would say doing Letting Go of God was probably the most performing at once. Once the show was solidified and I had an audience and I didn't have to worry about getting people in and the show was running and the reviews were good and I knew my lines, that was probably the most satisfying professional experience I've had.
What I got out of Letting Go of God was some of the strange little lies we tell our children.
Yes.
Santa Claus and God and...
Yes. Yeah, it's true.
And your book documents how you tried to talk to your daughter about Santa Claus.
Well, I never actually had a problem with Santa Claus. I mean, I liked Christmas. I didn't have a traumatic experience finding out that Santa Claus wasn't real. I enjoyed believing in him. It was okay. But when it came to telling my daughter about Santa Claus, it was really difficult for me to look in this face that's looking to you for the truth and protection and guidance and just blatantly lie. And it was I was unprepared by how much I viscerally did not want to lie to her. I mean, I could understand if it meant saving her life to lie, but like just to say these things. Anyway, so I didn't tell her about Santa Claus for the first two Christmases. And then by the time she was four, I had changed my mind completely. And I thought she's missing out on this great cultural heritage, this wonderful fantasy. I'm such a curmudgeon. What's wrong with me? And I just didn't realize that it was kind of already a little too late to introduce the idea of Santa Claus to a kid, even at four, because she had some critical thinking skills already. And so I just ended up scaring the hell out of her. I told her about Santa Claus on Christmas Eve. I said, there's a guy who's been watching you, who's been taking notes on whether you're good or bad, and he's going to come in our house tonight while we're sleeping, and he's going to leave you presents based on how good you were over the last year. And of course, I just scared her, and she was terrified, and it was terrible. It was a terrible experience. I ruined it for her.
She seems like a really sharp little kid.
Yeah, she definitely asks questions about stuff that I wasn't prepared for.
And in the car, too.
Yes, and in the car, yes. And bossy in the car, too. And asking questions in the car.
Well, I think when you're a suburban parent, you end up having most of your relationship with your children from the front and back seat.
I know. Actually, I have to say, it's really a nice thing. You know, looking right across at somebody can be really overpowering, and in some ways, it's too dominating, especially when you're the authority figure. So looking out the front window with them behind you in a seat where you can talk, I think it's a great place for great conversations.
When you were assembling your family, huge changes, not just marriage, this man's adopting your daughter, and then you moved to the Midwest from Los Angeles after growing up here in the Pacific Northwest.
Yes.
What kind of adjustment was that culturally to go to the suburbs of Chicago?
Well, probably this from being in an urban environment to a suburb was the biggest difficulty. Like, I would probably have the same difficulty going from Los Angeles to Sherman Oaks in a way. I mean, in some ways, because I like New York City, I like Los Angeles, I like Seattle, I like Portland. I like big urban environments with a big multi-culti, arty kind of crowd and scene. And we moved to a suburb that isn't that far out. It's actually right next to Evanston, which is a really cool place to live. But it's still a suburb. I mean, and it's really white, for one thing. I wasn't used to that. And it's very traditional family-y. And even though I'm actually a big supporter of one parent, I don't think it matters if it's the mother or the father, but being at home for the kids as much as that is possible. So I agree with a lot of the fundamentals of kind of a conservative suburb, but it's so not my people. Like, and that was a big adjustment. And I have found some mothers there that I really like, several actually, and I've kind of found my way, but that was a big adjustment, a big, big adjustment.
You adopted your daughter Mulan from China. What is it like raising a Chinese girl in a very white suburb?
Well, there actually are a lot. She knows, like, has four friends who are also adopted from China. And she has a friend who's Chinese and her family's Chinese who just came from China a couple of years ago and she didn't know any English. Her friend Julia, her name is. So she is actually around quite a few Asian adopted kids. And there is a percentage of Asians and Hispanics, and there's almost no African-American kids. That makes me feel sad. But I don't know. I guess I think Mulan's culture is adopted from China by white parents. I tried for so many years for her to learn Chinese. When she was little, I made sure her babysitters were Chinese at great effort. I tried to get her to learn Chinese. And then finally, I just kind of, there was a muscle that relaxed. Like, you know what? She ended up with me. She's really my culture. And we do include some Chinese things. On Chinese New Year, we go to Chinatown and eat. We try to cook Chinese food. And this year, we're going to China for 3 weeks. But I think she's a kid with a mixture for a background. And I think it's okay to be that way.
There's an essay in your new book that your daughter wrote.
Yes.
Specifically about her cultural heritage. Can you yes. tell us about that?
Well, that was in her fourth grade. They had an assignment, which I guess is the traditional year to do it, where they learn about immigration to America, and you know, they learn about Native Americans, and then you learn if you're not a Native American, you're really an immigrant here, and even Native Americans are immigrants. They just came 10,000 years earlier. And then they're sent home to write essays about how their family came to America, like what is the immigration history. And I guess I was surprised by, I didn't know that was coming, and I had realized that I had downplayed my interest in my heritage, you know, my family, which is part German and part Irish, because I always felt like it was a little unseemly to be too into ancestry when you've adopted a kid. Like, I just sort of naturally lost my interest in all that stuff. But then Mulan wrote this really beautiful essay. She was really into it. And she interviewed me about what I knew about my family. She interviewed Michael, my husband, about his family. And she wrote this essay, and she totally saw herself as an immigrant in a long line of immigrants, and has no problem being interested in the immigrant stories on Michael's side of the family or mine. And I was so appreciative to the teachers. You know, it was like, oh yeah, this is how to think about it. She's an immigrant. We're all immigrants. What are the stories? How did these immigrants come? How did they get together? And so I liked including it in the book because I have some possible heritage to some infamous characters in Chicago's history. And it was, I'm not even sure if I'm related to them, but they definitely were big parts of my grandparents' family life, and I just liked her take on it, Mulan's take on it, so I put it in the book.
She's got an interesting story, though. A different kind of immigrant. Someone went and brought her here.
Yes, it is different. I mean, this is kind of, I mean, I think probably in the last few generations those things have happened. Actually, because I really like to read science, popular science, because I'm not a scientist, but our human heritage is littered with people. That's one of the unique things about our species, is that we can bond as deeply with infants and children of other people as much as our own children. I mean, that's been a hallmark of our species. We care about children. We all together raise the children. It isn't just, You know, there's some species of animal where if you're not born of a certain mother, you'll be killed probably immediately. That really isn't true amongst humans so much. I think there was a lot of passing back and forth of children amongst tribes, in tribes. I think that tribes were strong when they realized things like maybe the birth mother wasn't as capable of raising the kid as other people in the tribe were, and people stepped in. And that's just part of our human heritage. So to me, yes, I went, you know, to China and got a kid, but it's kind of part of what it means to be a human to do something like that.
This book is a collection of essays. They run the gamut. You go from small humor to your brother Bill's death to your mother-in-law's abortion. There's some really deep and heartbreaking stuff in there, but what was your favorite essay to write?
Ooh. I guess I'm, favorite to write. Probably My Nemesis, because it isn't particularly deep and profound. It's pretty light, actually, but I wrote a lot of drafts of it where it wasn't that funny, and I can't say it's actually all that funny, but it is, I made it work, and it's actually true to what happened, but it took me a long time to crack the nut of that particular chapter, and like, when I would tell my husband about it, I could see on his face, it was like, yeah, I don't know if that one will make it in the book, like, that's not that good of a story, and I was like, no, that is a good story, and I'm gonna make it a good story, damn it, and I feel like I cracked that nut. So I guess that was my favorite feeling when I felt like I got that one. I think probably writing about my brother is my best writing in the book. And then I'm really proud of the one that I have of my mother-in-law and I talking about abortion and her experiences getting an abortion when it was illegal. And then I share experience of getting an abortion when it was legal, which is boring, although that's what an abortion should be. Boring. It was really a way for me to get closer to my mother-in-law, and it was unexpected. I was recording our conversation, and that's what came up, and that's what we recorded. And I don't know. I can't say what's my favorite. I do like the sex story. I feel like that story is fun and funny and awkward and goes places I think people don't expect, although that is exactly what happened. And I like the story on race, because I feel like people don't bring that one up, but I don't come to any conclusions about it. It's basically a story of me trying to make Mulan appreciate race, appreciate the hardships certain races of people have experienced in America, while not getting paranoid about being not a Caucasian. And then it kind of ends with this Korean mother at her school who is really a racist, you know, like, and it was just, I like that chapter too.
You're listening to KBOO. This is Between the Covers, and I'm Ren Green talking with Julia Sweeney about her new book, If It's Not One Thing, It's Your Mother. Tell the story about the Korean mother, please.
Mulan went to a public school that was 80% Korean, and at first I thought, like, actually it just makes me laugh at myself how naive I was. I just thought, oh, Mulan's Asian. So this is fantastic. You know, our local public school is mostly Asian, and it's also has a high African-American population and very few whites. Great. You know, this is where we live and this is the school and great. So we get to the school and I realize the Koreans are really, first of all, they have classes in Korean. It's a big Korean emphasis, and I didn't know how important it was for Mulan, my Cantonese daughter, to know that much about Korea. And then the kids in her class who were Korean were all friends with each other, and it was a very close-knit community. They were picked up by these vans after school and went to Christian after-school programs where they were learning their religion, and also they were studying really hard, and their idea of doing well in school is to get a perfect score, and it wasn't my idea of school, which was to understand, and I don't really care about grades, so that was a conflict. Anyway, so I was at this school in Mulan. You know, she really didn't have friends who were Asian because the kids who were Asian were Korean and they were friends with each other. And the kids who weren't Korean were not really invited to the parties and they weren't included in the group. And so there was just this funny moment where I had taken Mulan to Hawaii and she had gotten really, really dark. We were in the sun for like 2 weeks straight and it was just beautiful. Her skin, oh my God, it just drank up the rays. Like her body just wanted the sun. And we come back to school, and Mulan was at least as dark-skinned at that point as many of the African-American kids in school, which I thought was beautiful, and what the sun does to your skin when you're in it for 2 weeks and whatever. But I had a Korean mother come up to me and say, a Korean mother would never let that happen to her daughter. And I was like, what do you mean let that happen? I kind of couldn't stop talking, but like embarrassingly about, well, you know, you really don't need to use sunscreen if you have a kind of skin that likes the sun and not like mine, my pinky horrible skin. Like I was going on and on. And then she said, the thing is, she looks black and with a real negative tone. And then I completely wasn't prepared for that. And then Mulan came up and kind of heard the last part of our conversation. And then I was in the car trying to explain. Like I start, in typical fashion for me, I start this crazy long explanation of the history of how darker skinned people, because they worked out in the sun, became like the lower class. And then I realized Mulan does not care about it. She doesn't want to hear about it. She doesn't even know what I'm talking about. She's like, working out in the sun like Roberto, our friend who works out in the sun. I was like, no, not working out in the sun, working out in the sun. And then I just, she just changes the subject and I kind of end the chapter with, she doesn't even care about this. She does not even care about it. And why am I trying to explain too much? And anyway.
I related to how you just tried so hard to do the things you thought you were supposed to do and just eventually found your own way.
Well, what do you mean by like what kind of things I was supposed to do? Like
private school.
Oh, yes. Yes. Well, first, I sent her to this really fancy preschool in our neighborhood that was super expensive, but I could afford it. I was writing on TV shows and making a lot of money, and I wanted her to have the best, and I could afford the best, and why not have the best? So she was in this, really, when I look back on it, it just makes me laugh how much money I was spending on that school. And it was mostly celebrities and their kids, very high profile, very rich people. And I just ended up, I didn't like the feel of it. Actually, I have to say, over the years, now looking back on it, I don't think that school was so bad. It was a good school. It's just, I felt very elite. Like, we were elite. We were separated from all the other, the riffraff out there or whatever, and I didn't like it. So that's why when it came time for Mulan to go to kindergarten, I pulled her out and put her in just our local public school. But then I realized that that wasn't really ideal either. Budgets were being cut. If I had to do it over, I probably would have sent her to a private school in LA and just said, yeah, I'm in show business. I make enough money to go to the school. This is my culture too. Whatever. But at the time, I really wanted her to have this real world public school thing. And it really wasn't working out. The public school wasn't that good. There was all kinds of ways to get them into these magnet schools or specialized public schools, but I hadn't pursued it, and it was kind of too late for me to try to get her into those schools. I resented the fact that those schools existed because I thought there was just another way to create an elite amongst the public schools. And finally, I just gave up, moved to the Midwest, and enrolled my daughter into a very nice suburban school that is unfortunately very white and very, you know, it's wealthy. It's not like showbiz celebrity wealthy, but it's compared to the rest of the country wealthy. And I just accept that that's what happened. That's how it happened for us.
The minivan.
Yes.
You grew up in the 60s. I grew up in the 70s. And the family car was the station wagon.
Yeah, the station wagon.
And when the minivan started coming out, all my friends and I looked at each other and said, never, ever.
Oh, but see, I like it. First of all, we did not have a station wagon. We had a VW van. So to me, I already came from the VW van point of view. I thought, the thing I don't like about the SUVs, which became popular, is you can't seat that many people. You only can seat what you can seat in a sedan. It doesn't really give you more people moving power.
Right, just get you 2 feet off the ground.
The minivan, you can seat 8 people easily in my minivan, and I can fold down all the seats so you can put a bunch of stuff in it. I love my minivan. I embraced it. And but I have to say, in our neighborhood, everybody has an Honda Odyssey. Everyone. It's like we have a uniform car, and that is the car that you're supposed to have. But I do like it. If we end up staying in the Midwest, which I never thought we would until this last few months when I was just loving it so much that I thought, maybe we'll stay here. I don't know. But when Mulan goes to college in 5 years, or whatever she does in 5 years, I would continue driving the minivan. It's so convenient. I cart people around.
So your daughter's 13 now.
Yes.
Does she have any grand plans for her life yet?
No, she's still thinking about stuff. It's really interesting. Well, she's a dancer. She really dances a lot. She's got like 5 dance classes a week, and next week it'll be 6. And it's really a rigorous program. And she's also a piano player. So she's really into piano and dance. I don't know how that translates into a job, although she met somebody who dances with the Joffrey in Chicago professionally, and she thought she's kind of really smitten with this girl, so maybe that's something she'll do. Actually, she has a real entrepreneurial side to her. She's going to go on tour this summer. Jill Sobule, this musician, and I are doing this thing called the Jill and Julia Show. Actually, we're going to be here in September, but in the summer, we're doing like a tour for 2 weeks in the Northeast, and Mulan's going to go, and she's our merch girl, and she is a salesperson. Like, she's got the salesperson part of her is very strong. She really, I'm like, wow, you should go into business. Like, you really are good. So I don't know what you'll do.
When you were hiring nannies,
yes,
you talk about how you hate being a boss.
Yes.
Are you not a business person?
I do have a problem being a boss. I do. I have an assistant right now who works for me like 1 hour a week. She really just helps me organize my email and make sure I answer the things I have to answer. And that's worked out really well. And I have directed things before where I had to direct a whole crew, but that part came easily to me because everybody's job was so clear and I knew what I wanted. But just sort of getting people to do things and keep them happy on this long, ongoing basis, I'm terrible at that. I don't like it. I feel like I have a lot of energy for it at the beginning, and then I just don't have any energy for it at all after a few months.
What else have you got going on besides this book and the Jill and Julia Show?
Well, I'm a voice in this Pixar movie that's coming out in June called Monsters University, and I'm the voice of Mrs. Squibbles. It's actually a small part, but they're kind of promoting my character a lot, and that's exciting. And then I think I'm going to write a book of fiction. I haven't decided 100%, but I've decided 95%. I have a story. I was writing it as a screenplay, but my editor at Simon Schuster thinks it's a book, and I just feel so flattered that she thinks it could be a book, and she's a really great editor, and I think I want to go for it and try to write a novel, a fiction novel.
For adults or kids or?
No, for adults. It's about a marriage breaking up after, on the week of their kids graduating from high school.
Are you trying to say something?
I know. My husband, when I told him the story, he's like, is this your fantasy? I go, okay, maybe a little. But, you know, I don't want him, in the story, the husband has gotten someone pregnant, and it's terrible in a whole bunch of different ways aside from the obvious ways, and I don't want that to happen, and I do want to stay married to my husband, but I do feel like I have this grand project of raising this kid, and when she, I know it doesn't end when they go to college or after they're 18, but I do know that you don't have to be home at night for them anymore, and I'm really excited about it, and I like that my main character, the whole idea of the book is that it's seems terrible the whole way through, and then at the end you realize she's gotten a get out of jail free card. That's it.
Oh, well, I can tell you it's great when they leave home. It's awesome. It's like, who was I before? I don't remember. Now I'm going to figure it out again.
Yeah. No, I mean, I think I know a lot of women in their 50s, and I'll be like, well, 60 almost when it happens for me, but they're strong, they're youthful, their mind is quick, and they have so many more years to go back to that person they were before they had kids. And I really am fascinated by that time in a woman's life.
I had my son when I was 23. Women with college degrees who have babies at 23 are very rare. Now I have friends who are getting started in their 40s, and I just look at that. It's like, wow, you took all this time, you made all your mistakes, you finally figured out who you are.
Right.
And now you're putting, now you're all about this other human being. And that for me is very strange.
I think like, there's
I don't know adult life without kids.
Right.
I'm learning about it now, actually.
Yeah. I mean, I'm actually jealous of some of my friends who started early and who are done. And I started late. You know, there's 40 years difference between me and Mulan. But for me, it was good because I was really tired of the outside world. I didn't want to go out to concerts or parties. I was ready to stay home. I wanted an excuse to stay home.
So let's talk about your writing process. Are you a fast writer? You'd go through many drafts? Or
Some of the stories went through many, many drafts, and some of them didn't. They're all like a kid who has different needs. Some are special needs. Some are geniuses. No, I don't know if that's true, but I write in the morning. I try to say to myself, even though there were many days I had to write afternoon, I mostly feel like afternoon, I don't want to do output anymore. I'm ready for input. So I have kind of a policy of getting up and writing and I write a journal every morning, and that helps me get my thoughts sorted for about 45 minutes. And then I do my power hour of writing. That's what I call it, where I turn off the internet. I know what I'm writing, and I have a pure hour, which for me is hard to get through. 1 hour. 1 hour. Then sometimes I catch fire during the hour, and I write for several more hours. And sometimes I can't wait for the hour to be over, and I'm done. And then I exercise and do the rest of my day. And that's, I kind of realized, like I was just talking to Jess Walter, who's from Spokane, who has this book, The Beautiful Ruins. And he's like a great writer. He's really a great writer. And he was telling me about his day, and he spends many hours every morning. He has a beautiful schedule, actually. And I thought, I'm going to be like that. And then I thought about it and thought about it. And I thought, I don't know if I can be like that. I don't think I can be like that. I think my power hour is as good as I can do. And just doing that power hour, you know, like 6 days a week, takes all of my conniving with myself, cajoling myself, being mad at myself, you know, bribing myself. That is really the most I can do. And I think if I tried to suddenly do a power 5 hours, I would do it for 3 days and then not write for 6 months. So I feel like I'm just going to stick with my power hour, and I'm going to see if that turns into, I think in a year I can do a book doing that, and I'm going to try to do it. God, I just finished reading the best book that I recommend to anyone who wants to write, called Becoming a Writer by Dorothea Brand, and it was written in 1934, and it's a beautiful, beautiful book that if I had just read this book when I was 20, I think I would have had a different life, even though I'm happy with my life, but I'm just saying it was so inspiring, and she has all kinds of great advice, but one of them I really agree with, and that is, once you write something, do not read it over right then. You have to go and sleep and distance yourself from it. You might have to wait a week. Don't tell anyone how great it is. Don't tell anyone how terrible it is. Most of all, yourself, both those things. Just don't think about it and pick it up later when you can have some rest in between. And that is definitely true for me, because I've written things where I thought, that was great. And then I read it a couple days later and it's really not great. Or there's things that I was about to trash, but then once I looked at them again later, they weren't so bad. And they were kind of salvageable. So that's one of my things that I do. But that book is great, Becoming a Writer. Man, that's a great book.
So she advocates creating a fresh space for yourself.
Yes, she has all these things. And a lot of them I've come to intuitively over time about waking up and writing first thing. I do my diary, but after reading this book, I might try to do, because she has this whole idea that the plot comes from the unconscious and you can't really control it, but you can create conditions in which the subconscious or the unconscious can do better work for you. And a lot of it is about waking up and getting right into your creative process without anything in between. Now, I have to get my daughter off to school, so there's all kinds of things that have to happen for me in the morning. But I do agree. Like, I feel like the plots I've come up with for television or film, or even for this book I want to write, it just comes to me in the night, and I kind of wake up and it's there. And I really want to figure out ways that I can nurture that, whatever's happening in my brain, create the conditions for that to happen more often.
Well, thank you for talking to me, Julia.
Thank you. This was really fun.
That was Julia Sweeney, actress and author of It's Not One Thing, It's Your Mother. You've been listening to Between the Covers. I'm Ren Green for KABU.
Between the Covers was made possible in part by KABU Foundation members and a grant from the Clinton Street Theater, featuring independent and revival films, the Rocky Horror Picture Show every Saturday at midnight, as well as the monthly KABU Movie Night. The Clinton Street Theater is located at the corner of Southeast Clinton and 26th in Portland. Schedule and information at 503-238-5588 or cstpdx.com. It's 11:28. Jen Chavez is up next with the film show. Thank you, KABU members, for your generous support. If you are not a KABU member, you can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate today.
Where is your radio dial on Thursday afternoons from noon until 2? 90.7 FM is the place to be. Twice a month, DJ Charlie presents the Worldbeat Connection with the hottest Afro-Caribbean sounds in Portland radio land. Reggae, salsa, soca, New Orleans Afro-funk, Haitian compa and rara, and Antillean zouk share the airwaves with African high life, Afrobeat, Congolese soukous, Malian blues, juju, and South African kwaito, among the other great styles. Traditional and modern expressions are all included. On alternate weeks, check out Top Rankin' Reggae and Dancehall with Shocks of Sheba show, hosted by Teresa and Michelle. Any week, Thursdays at noon is sure to move ya.
Good morning and welcome to The Film Show on KABU, spotlighting Portland's independent film and video scene. I'm your host, Jen Chavez. Today our show dips beneath the radar of mainstream film and calls attention to two unique local programs dedicated to experimentation, underrepresented art forms, and underground filmmakers. Soon I'll be joined live by the festival director of this August's Portland Underground Film Festival, or PUFF. But first, we'll turn our attention to the Pacific Northwest College of Arts' upcoming Boundary Crossings Institute in Animated Arts. This year marks the third biannual run of the two-week institute, which will last from Monday, July 29th through August 9th. Artists Rose Bond and Miriam Harris joined me recently here at KABU to discuss what we can expect from this year's program. Today I'm joined by Rose Bond, the director of PNCA's upcoming Boundary Crossings Institute, and Miriam Harris, a visiting artist who will take part in this year's institute and also is a past participant. Thank you so much for joining me.
Glad to be here.
Great.
Nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you, too. So first I want to get at the concepts on which the institute is based. It's been described as blurring the boundaries between different types of moving images and exploring an expanded notion of the screen. How has a departure from the traditional screen and traditional ideas of animation spurred the